everybody. Oh, excuse me. Hello, everybody. That was interesting, wasn't it? Test 1, 2 on my vocal cords. Hello, everybody. I was just like so relaxed listening to the opening music there, which my brother, Barry Hartglass, wrote. And I've been listening to it for over 10 years. And it still makes me happy when I hear it, because that means my favorite show is going to be on. Oh, that's this show. You're listening to It's All About Food with me, Karen Hartglass. Thank you for joining me today. We're going to have a nice program today about some very nice things happening in the world. And who doesn't like to hear nice things? I do. And it gets challenging sometimes because we're flooded with all the not nice things that are happening. But good things are happening and we're celebrating them here right now. And I'm going to bring on two nice people, Leora Raphael and Glenn Sachs. They're lawyers and longtime friends, and over lunch at a favorite vegan restaurant, Leora relayed her frustration in finding an age-appropriate book for her daughter to assist in answering the question, why don't we eat animals? And Glenn, never want to turn down a challenge, said, let's write one. And here we are today to talk about their book, Happy Animals, Friends, Not Food. Hello, Leora, and hello, Glenn.
Hi. Thank you so much for having us.
Hi. Sure. I'm glad we finally made this happen. It's always challenging juggling everyone's schedules.
Indeed. It is.
But you're here. Thank you. So I thought we'd take a moment where you could both, one at a time, share your individual stories, the veil was lifted story, where you realize who was on your plate. Let's start with
Leora. Sure. Okay.
Oh, with me?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. So I grew up eating the typical diet of, a relatively good amount of meat. Interestingly, as a child, I didn't really love it, but we grew up in a home where there were a lot of, corned beef sandwiches and briskets and things like that, always at the table. Never really enjoyed dairy. My grandmother used to try to bribe me to drink it by offering me money, and I would climb under the table and hide because I didn't like it, but didn't really know anything about it. And as I got older, still didn't love meat, but would eat it, would go out for a burger. And then when I was in college, and I think this is talked about in my bio in the book, I was waiting for a friend in a bookstore. I came across a book called Victims of Vanity about the makeup industry. So interestingly, not about the food industry, but about, animal testing with cosmetics and laundry products and other products, and was really horrified and decided to only purchase cruelty-free products from then on. But then very, very quickly thereafter, decided to become vegetarian. But I always thought, I'm not eating animals and I'm not eating fish, but, with eggs and with dairy, I mean, they're not killing the animals, so it's okay, and continued on as a vegetarian for many, many years. And then Glenn and I ended up meeting, and he was, I think in the process, or at that point, he was also vegetarian and thinking about going to vegan. He can get more into that. And listening to him talk about why he was making that life change really had me thinking about it. And I started reading about the dairy industry and the egg industry, and very, very quickly just gave up the rest of the products as well, including honey. I don't eat honey. And have really loved that lifestyle. So I've been a full vegan for just over 11 years.
Hooray, Leora.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. The planet thanks you. Okay, let's hear Glenn's story.
Sure. Like probably almost all of us, certainly of a certain age, I grew up in a, standard household too, eating everything. But I did, we were certainly animal lovers, and I do remember being very traumatized, in particular fishing. We didn't hunt in my family, but I really did not like fishing. It was very traumatic to me seeing the fish suffer. But like most people, you rationalize and compartmentalize. And I just, had a standard diet until, I'd say, it was sometime probably around the year 2000, I remember there was an EarthSave office actually in this, I believe it was at the base of the Space Needle somewhere in Seattle when I was there visiting. Mm-hmm. And I picked up some materials there, and that made an impression on me. But it wasn't until a few years later that I had read Diet for a New America, I think, which I know you're familiar with. And I think that's what I think that's what pushed me over the edge to finally realize, like, I just couldn't live with these contradictions as someone who's empathetic and loves animals. And then I wasn't vegetarian for very long, because if you become vegetarian for animal reasons and you start getting into it and you're buying products and you meet other people, it probably only took a few months for me to realize I couldn't rationalize eating milk and eggs as well. So it was a pretty brief transition once I became vegetarian.
Fantastic. So your stories are not unusual.
Mm-hmm.
So a few things just always blow my mind. So I don't know why more people don't have these realizations like you have had, because many people have had them, but not enough, in my opinion. And then the other thing is, which is why your book is important, and we're going to get to that in a moment, we're often in our culture given a foundation of information, and some of it isn't really factual. It's a big fantasy, and we build on it, and we build experiences, and we build relationships and family ties, all based on a big lie.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it comes from little children's books.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can think of many. And we need more books that tell the truth. So let's talk about happy animals.
Sure.
Happy animals, friends, not food. Now, did you take the line "friends, not food" from the movie Finding Nemo?
No, we definitely didn't. As attorneys, we researched this as well, and it's actually preceded Finding Nemo by many years in use, just all over the place in common usage. So we're kind of glad that helped popularize it.
Sure, I loved that part of the movie. That was my favorite part, when the sharks are trying to be vegetarian and they say, "Fish are your friends, not food." I love that.
Yeah,
that was a great movie. I actually saw it years ago when it was in the theaters, and I don't know when it came out. So at the time, Glenn and I came up with the title of the book, I had long forgotten anything about that line in the movie. And then just rewatched it a few months ago with my children, and then heard the line. But no, it was not we didn't base the title on that line in the movie. Although it is a great line all around.
Yes, it is a great line all around, and I don't care where it came from. The point is, it's the truth. Friends are not food, and so many people call non-human animals their friends and then sit down and eat them. Mm-hmm. Maybe not a particular animal they know, but something very closely related.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
So,
right.
What do we find in the book? I've read it. It's got some great pictures. Yeah, but what do we find in the book?
Glenn, do you want to
Sure. Thanks for bringing that up, Karen. Like the the pictures were a big part of it. We doing a lot of research. I mean, we were at Barnes & Noble's reading and other bookstores reading all the books we can get our hands on. And Leora had a lot of experience from raising her children, who, when we started this, were probably her oldest daughter was of the age where the book would have been targeted to. And what we noticed was a character. You know, when we had first had the idea, we thought we would just talk about cows and pigs and turkeys and some of their attributes. And then we realized that children really identify with a character. You know, all children's cartoons, starting from Mickey Mouse to just almost every children's book, it's a named character. So we thought that would be the theme. So we picked the six most commonly eaten animals, at least in you know, North America. And we, for each one, we made a named character, and we kind of decided to do a very similar introduction. So it's kind of a rhyming cadence that repeats, because that's another thing that children in this book, by the way, is aimed at children from pretty much 2 to 7, somewhere in there. But that type of repetition, if you know about children's programming on TV, really resonates. So we wanted to weave those two elements throughout the book. And then, of course, the illustrations, our illustrator, Susan, really got exactly what we wanted and just did a fantastic job. We wanted to make the book bright and cheerful and kind of connect, make a bridge on the common disconnect that we were just talking about for kids, but not in a dark or scary way that would be age inappropriate for a child of that age.
We really wanted kids to read this and smile as they read it and be happy when they finish reading it with their parents, or on their own even. We wanted it to just be a really positive, cheerful book. You know, there's so much dark information out there about the food industry and the factory farming that is depressing and dark and very hard to watch and hard to read. And you could educate children that way by showing them what the industry is and making them very sad and, you know, somewhat traumatized in some instances. But we really wanted to take a different approach. We just really wanted anyone reading the book just to feel very cheerful and positive.
I recently got a comment on my nonprofit website, Responsible Eating and Living, on an interview I did with someone years ago who has some programs for children. And she teaches or has programs that she presents in junior high schools and high schools. And this particular mom was complaining about a program my colleague had done in a high school, where she showed some images of animals in slaughterhouses, in factory farms, and the mom thought it was totally inappropriate for these high school students. And I just thought that was fascinating, because high school students, okay, we're not talking about ages 2 or 3 to 7, mm-hmm. high school students, this is where high school students learn to drive. They have the permission to mm-hmm. operate a vehicle. If they turn 18 before they graduate high school, they can be drafted into wars.
Yeah.
I think high school students can manage a lot of information, but they don't need any filters. And perhaps it's important to be gentler to younger people. But I think what you really succeeded in this book, because these animals are in a sanctuary. And children may be inquisitive about what they're doing there, but it is happy and it is colorful and they all look happy and cuddly. But it's
but
you're not lying. You're telling the truth. Right. And that's what's great about it.
Right. And the challenge
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, the challenge was in making the connection. Like, you notice they're saying, you know, we don't want to be a hamburger and we don't want to be on a barbecue, but doing it in a way so we're getting the point across, but it's still cute. And that's, it took a long time to strike that balance the way we wanted to.
And it is so interesting how you talk about high school, because as Glenn mentioned, when we started writing the book, my daughter was the age that, you know, on the higher end of the age range that we think of for this book, but she's older now. She just turned 11. And it's interesting how our conversation, and my son is 7 years old, and it's so interesting how my conversations with them evolve over the years as they get older. And we now, regularly volunteer at a local sanctuary, so they're really getting to know some of the animals there, and we're going more regularly, and it's just so wonderful to see their relationship with these animals. We just we have a dog who we've had for about 11 and a half years before my daughter was born, and we just adopted two guinea pigs from the Los Angeles Guinea Pig Rescue. And it's wonderful to have animals in the home, but for also to have them go out and actually volunteer with the pigs and the chickens and the turkeys and the alpacas and the goats. And it's just so fabulous. And our conversations now are really evolving as they're getting older. And we are starting to have some conversations about slaughterhouses. And I do plan to take my daughter in the next month or so to a Los Angeles Pig Save event, which is going to be heartbreaking, but yep. Important, so important. She's not going to see the pig slaughtered, obviously, but it's so important for me to take her and have her see people, just trying to give the pigs a little bit of love.
I think it also helps empower the children mm-hmm. when we tell them the truth and we show them positive alternatives to some of the horror that's going on in the world.
Yeah. Yes, I absolutely agree.
And children need to feel empowered. And children mm-hmm. need to see that their parents are present and active and not just blasé about everything. Because this is we are living in very challenging times. I think all of humanity's history has been challenging. There's been darkness in every era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we're bombarded with it now with social media. And it's really affecting children in many ways negatively. Mm-hmm. And children and young adults need to know that they can make a difference. There are solutions.
Exactly.
I'm depending on your kids.
I completely agree. But it is frustrating. My kids both go to the same school, and it's a wonderful school. But last year the theme of my daughter's grade was the environment, and they did so much work and so many projects on the environment and what to do to help the environment. And there was not one word about factory farming or anything related. And it was I think that we find that really everywhere, that schools will have an environmental component or a nutrition component, and this is completely left out.
And the question is it because they're ignorant? Is it because they're given materials and information that doesn't include it? We can't always blame them
mm-hmm. yeah,
for not, but it could be that they just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's where the children come in, because they need to teach their teachers.
Yeah. And I believe my daughter did.
Yes. In a loving, non-judgmental way.
Of course. Exactly. Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Can we talk about Thanksgiving?
Of course.
And yes. And how this book might help people with that traditional holiday that we celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. What that was really important to us, Karen, was including turkeys. Number one, they are not only on Thanksgiving, but, all year long, eaten so commonly. And they're probably one of the most misunderstood farm animals out there, even though they all are. So it was very, very important to us to include Tasha the turkey in the book and introduce turkeys and make this connection that, Thanksgiving is, for turkeys, it's not a fun day and giving thanks. And we have that beautiful picture of, the picnic with all the children and the turkeys together. And I love seeing that when at sanctuaries, when they actually have a dinner on the day of Thanksgiving with the turkeys joining in. It's one of the really nice things to see. So it was very, very important for us to include turkeys. And Leora might have more to add in terms of how she handles the holiday.
Yes, I mean, Thanksgiving is a very difficult holiday for me, because it's a holiday to spend with family, and we love our family, so, you know, we want to be at the dinner, but it's a difficult holiday for me. You know, obviously, most holidays that we have, if we have a brunch or a dinner with our family or friends, they're, you know, it's not going to be a vegan dinner, which is why I personally don't tend to host them in our home, but we do go. And, you know, all I can do is try to set an example and make the most delicious food. We're having a Thanksgiving brunch this year because a few family members couldn't make it to dinner. And, you know, all I can do is just bring a fabulous dessert. I'm going to make an incredible mac and cheese dish and a few sides. We're going to a dinner later that night at a friend's house, and her mom is vegan, and her brother, I believe, is vegan or vegetarian. So again, just an opportunity for me to make fabulous dishes for everybody, and just hope that, you know, people taste my pumpkin cheesecake and my mac and cheese and my farro salad and all the delicious things that I make to understand that you don't need turkey and the other, you know, the other Thanksgiving traditional foods to have an incredible, beautiful meal.
I'm ready to come over and taste them. They sound pretty good to me.
I've already been going through my cookbooks looking for the perfect recipes. I really enjoy it.
That's great. I've waffled over the years about how to handle Thanksgiving. I think vegetarians and vegans own Thanksgiving in a certain way. It seems to be the most important holiday because meat is not only featured on the table, but it's such a ironic themed holiday where we're giving thanks. We're grateful for all of the things that we have, and yet we display our gratitude with an innocent, tortured, slaughtered bird on the table. And it's also ironic because that's not how the original Thanksgiving dinner was supposed to be, at least from what I've read. I wasn't there, and I don't know anybody else who was to know for sure. But it was all about the harvest, and it was about the three sisters, squash and beans and corn, and how wonderful they all treat each other while they're growing up together, and how deliciously they cook together in a meal. It wasn't about the bird.
And exactly, and how nutritious they are. I mean, I love root vegetables, so this time of year is one of my favorites.
And when you see, you know, for example, Facebook posts on Thanksgiving, so many parents post photos of their children, you know, wearing the turkey costumes. And I remember when my daughter was in preschool, I think she was maybe 3 years old, I went to the Thanksgiving little festival that they had. I don't know what they called it, because it was a few years ago. And I hadn't really thought about it. I was just sort of a new mom, and I hadn't been to anything like this before, and I went in really excited because they were going to sing songs, and I was in the audience with all the other parents, and there's my little girl on the stage singing songs I'll never forget, and some of the words of the songs were 7, 8, 9, the turkey tastes so fine, and then another song had the words gobble gobble fat turkey, and I mean, I just started shaking. I was so upset, and I said to the teacher after, you know this, you know, why wasn't I told that she would be singing these songs? But it wouldn't even have occurred to them, even though they knew, you know, about my family, and it wouldn't even have occurred to them. And no one thought about the connection of having, you know, my daughter on the stage singing, you know, 7, 8, 9, the turkey tastes so fine. There really is a disconnect.
Huge. A huge disconnect. And thank you for educating that teacher. And hopefully that teacher will think again about singing that song.
You know, I don't believe that they sing it anymore.
That's good. You know, and then And then there are people that complain about the climate today, how everything is politically incorrect, and how we can't do all these things that we'd like to do. And in some ways, maybe we have gone a little beyond with the politically incorrect, but I think for the most part, it's all good and it's all educational, and people need to be mindful. People need to know we're not all the same. People need to know we don't all celebrate the same things. People need to start thinking and not sleepwalking.
Mm-hmm. Very much.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I want to mention Die for New America for a moment, because Glenn, you brought it up, and what a powerful thing, how one book can influence so many people. And there are many, many wonderful activists today, authors, who have written books, and all as a result of reading that one book. And here it is today. You, Glenn, acknowledged that influence the book had on you, and here you are with Happy Animals. Such a wonderful legacy for John and for all of us to receive. Really. John Robbins, that is, the author of Died for a New America.
Yeah, what a powerful book. And now we have, you know, in addition, kind of the modern version of that, I don't know how many people read books anymore, is you know, movie documentaries on Netflix that can appeal to a audience that, you know, there's three avenues towards changing your diet. One are people who are coming purely from a health standpoint, health and athletics, which is a valid way, and hopefully they'll learn about the ethical part of it as they're getting into it. And then you have environmental, and then you have like Leora and I, who came from straight in from the ethical, you know, treatment of animals angle, but hopefully there's a lot of crossover between the three.
Well, whatever brings people to the party, I support. But I do believe that those who come here to this party, and it's a party, it's a delicious party, those who come from the animal ethical point of view, I think they understand a lot more a lot quickly. And it's not just animals, but how we treat each other and how we treat the planet and how exploitation is not a good thing.
Just bringing up one more book, which I know you're familiar with, the book Allowed to Grow Old, The Photographs of the Animals at the Sanctuary by Issa Leshko.
Yes, I have two copies, and I'm waiting to give them to special people, but what a great book.
So I love photography. I always bring my camera when I go to a sanctuary, and I have her book. And so I was very pleasantly surprised when I saw her book mentioned on your Facebook page, and that you had interviewed her. And what an incredibly beautiful book that is. The photographs are stunning. I just love it. Every time I look at it, I am so happy. They're just stunning, stunning photographs of these beautiful animals.
Well, I believe that she has touched a chord with some people in a very unique way, because in children's books, for example, we see cute, adorable little cartoon animals. And maybe in petting farms, we see cute, adorable little baby animals. And we rarely see old cows and pigs and chickens and turkeys, because they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And they should.
They definitely should.
Yeah. So that's why that book to me was so profound. And I'm glad that she's getting a lot of recognition for it.
I am too.
I want to get back just briefly to your book, Happy Animals, Friends, Not Food.
Yes.
I'm sure you're aware of this, but those wonderful, colorful, cuddly, friendly, adorable images of animals that you use so lovingly in this book. Pictures like that are also used in marketing to make it look like the animals want to be eaten.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to fight that. That's really bad.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. We see the trucks on the road with, you know, for the dairy companies, with a picture of a very happy, smiling cow, the commercials with the cute chickens for the chicken products. Definitely not an accurate portrayal of what's really happening.
Exactly. And that's why how we have the book laid out, when you're introduced, like Callie the cow, for example, and she's introducing herself and talking about cows, and then with each chapter, the last picture is bringing back that connection. Like, yes, we're cute, but we want to stay this way. You know, we want to hang out with our moms in the field. We don't want to be, you know, on your kitchen plate. And that's what we keep coming back to over and over in the book, is that exact marketing ploy, you know, you just mentioned, and how to counteract it.
So I'm thinking, do you, each of you have favorite children's books that you remember? And part two of that question is, are those books, or maybe some related programs, did they have information in it that you discovered was kind of distorted? It's not something that jumps right to the fore.
No, I loved reading as a child. I was an avid reader, and I still am. But I'm suddenly drawing a blank on any books I read. I'm remembering, you know, Nancy Drew and the Bosley Twins.
Sure.
What, Glenn?
I do remember a couple. One was Charlotte's Web.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Of course, you know, relating to a pig. And the other one, I don't know if any of you have heard of it, but the author's name was Richard Scarry. And all of his books were populated by animals, you know, pigs, mice, dogs. Now, they were, I'm not sure if I'm saying the word right, but like anthropomorphic, where they're actually, you know, dressed up like people, walking on two legs, you know, doing people things. So that's really, it's cute, and it's a nice way to portray things. But again, I think that almost encourages the disconnect. And we made a conscious decision right away that we did not want animals, you know, walking on two legs and, you know, having a glass of water in their hands and that type of thing. We wanted them to actually, you know, be biologically a representative of the actual animal.
That's really good. It's not something that I realized while looking at the book, and I appreciate that, because once again, there's so many subliminal things that we're not aware we're seeing when we see it.
Mm-hmm.
That's very good. I just want to mention that I think Sesame Street is having their 50th anniversary year of broadcasting, and I was watching their first shows when my brother was young, and I was about 11 or 12, and there was one program that I cannot forget, and when I was watching it then, I didn't realize that they were lying. And then decades later, it played back in my mind, and that was when they showed cows. And the line was, a cow makes much too much milk for her young calf to drink.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, I remembered all the songs, and I used to memorize all the verses and the poetry, and that was one line that just stuck with me, and it was false.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So I hope they don't do that anymore. I don't know. I don't watch Sesame Street anymore. Okay, so thank you for writing Happy Animals, Friends, Not Food. Is there anything else you would like to tell us about this book before I let you both go back to your very busy lives?
Well, one thing I wanted to mention quickly is the publishing company from this book is actually Vegan Publishers. So that was another important choice we made. We really felt good about actually getting published by a vegan publishing company. So the book's available on their website as well as the usual Amazon and Barnes & Noble. But that was a conscious decision we made as well.
I like that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay, I have one more question before I let you go. I keep thinking of things. I want to know, were you two ate when you were thinking about writing this book? And where do you like to go in Los Angeles? That's where you live, right? Somewhere Southern California, Los Angeles?
Yes. At the time that we came up with the idea, Gwen was working close to a restaurant called Follow Your Heart.
Oh, yeah.
And we used to meet there for lunch. And it is to this day one of my favorite restaurants. It's not very far from where we live, about 15 minutes from our house, so where I live with my family. And so even Glenn has not worked in the area for many years. I still go to that restaurant all the time. I love it. And then I think we each have many favorite restaurants in LA. I personally love Real Food Daily, Okada. My kids love Veggie Grill, so we're at Veggie Grill about once a week.
Mm-hmm.
they're too near our house, and they're finally eating things other than the kids' menu. So their new favorite is the BLTA, which is absolutely fantastic. So I love Veggie Grill. We love native foods when we're in Orange County or Westwood. I mean, I could go on for an hour about all the restaurants. We are so fortunate to live in Los Angeles where, you know, not only are there so many vegan-only restaurants, but there are restaurants with vegan menus and no shortage of things to eat. And I'll also add that the Whole Foods tempeh sandwich, I think I get that about once a week. So not a restaurant, but, oh, my goodness, one of my favorite things.
Okay, that's good to know. What surprises me is that Los Angeles is rich in vegan-only restaurants in addition to restaurants that have options, but it's not true in Northern California. I don't know why that is, and I hope it's going to change soon.
I noticed that.
Very
we were in San Francisco a year ago, and I was so excited because I thought we would have the most amazing vegan food, and we did. We did have incredible food, but I was surprised. I was looking on Happy Cow for restaurants, and I was surprised there weren't more. But we ended up eating fabulously on that trip, so I have nothing to complain about.
No, we're all very fortunate. All right. Well, thank you both for writing Happy Animals, Friends, Not Food, and for living your lives the way you feel is good for your families and for the planet. Very important. And keep doing what you're doing. Thank you so much for finding me and for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks for having
me. Okay. Take care. Okay, everybody, that was Glenn Sachs and Leora Raphael, the authors of Happy Animals, Friends, Not Food. So my recommendation is you buy this book and you skip the turkey during Thanksgiving and you read this book aloud at the table with everyone. I think it could be a fun new tradition. We all make different choices on Thanksgiving, and we have to do what is most comfortable for ourselves. Sometimes we will take different priorities. Some say, I absolutely will not attend when there's a dead bird on the table. I'm raising my hand. I did that for years. I was fortunate because my immediate family said, okay, we won't have turkey. And then things change over years because people get married, other families join other families. There's dynamics, there's movement, and you may not be able to have your tofurkey and eat it too, all in the same place without a dead bird on the table. It's challenging. So I wish you all well with your Thanksgivings and the choices that you make. May you be at peace. What really isn't a good idea is to be on the defensive and attack. I always say, come from a place of love. As Leora had mentioned earlier, she brings all these delicious foods to her dinner. That's the best way to do it. Put wonderful vegan delicious food in people's mouths and have them realize, I'm not going to be deprived. And Thanksgiving is probably one of the easiest times because it's easy to make mashed potatoes that are vegan. And there's so many different ways to do it. We have a recipe at responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's rich and delicious. We use a cashew cream instead of a dairy milk. It makes it very rich and yummy. And now there are a variety of different over-the-top vegan butters that are available today. I mean, when I first started out as a vegan 31 years ago, I would look for margarines. And margarines were gross 30 years ago. But I used them to make a variety of different recipes where I wanted to have something. And I ended up using margarines that had hydrogenated oils in them. And I'm so grateful that nowadays we have some really wonderful products made with quality ingredients. For example, Miyoko's cultured vegan butter is really good. And you can make apple pie, pumpkin pie, all kinds of pies. We have all of those recipes for you for free at responsibleeatingandliving.com. There are many vegan books out today that have comparable recipes too. So many options to choose from. And we have a food show. If you haven't seen it, it's at the responsibleeatingandliving.com website. We did that a few years ago, and we make some of our very favorite Thanksgiving recipes in that particular show. Okay. We talked about dairy, milk, and cheese. Leora was talking about how she went vegetarian first and was eating milk and cheese. And I was just talking about butter. And in our culture, milk and cheese and butter are important staples. Unfortunately, today, there are many plant-based versions of all of these things. And as a result, you may have heard that Dean Foods, America's largest milk producer, is filing for bankruptcy. The company's 94 years old, and now they're struggling because Americans are drinking less cow's milk. And that's a great thing. Now, I'm not sure what's going to happen to this company. I'm reading that they're hoping that they're bought up by another company, and perhaps the production will continue, just maybe not as much as before. I'm really not sure what's going to happen, but there's always a happy part and a sad part of a story, and people will perceive the news as good or bad depending on their point of view. So I'm imagining that while I'm celebrating that a dairy company is going bankrupt because people are consuming less milk, I'm sure there are many people that are, as a result, are going to struggle. People that work for Dean Foods in a variety of ways, maybe they will be let go. And that's a difficult thing to deal with. What I'm saying is we want to celebrate, but there are some things that are just difficult and not a celebration. What I would love to see, and I just want to talk about this and put it out there, because I believe when we voice our ideas, the universe will hear them and perhaps it'll have an opportunity, like a seed, to be planted and grow. But wouldn't it be wonderful if our society recognized that some businesses weren't as popular as they were before? Let's talk about the dairy industry. Let's talk about the coal industry. These are two industries that aren't as needed as they used to be for a variety of reasons. So what really needs to happen is for the government to come in and help the people that are involved in these industries transition to something else. So dairy farmers, for example, rather than getting subsidies to stay in business, and rather than being bailed out when sales are down, they could be given compensation to transition. They could transition to an organic farm. They could transition to a plant milk manufacturer, like Elmhurst Dairy did. So there are ways where a company could go out of business, but the people aren't as negatively affected. And then that would be just an amazing celebration all around, because society would be improving all around. Okay, I put it out there. That's done. I remember, we've talked about this a number of times, and I still don't know what's happened today, but in the 70s, I think it happened, where the Finnish government realized their population was getting too overweight, and they encouraged dairy farmers to transition over to growing raspberries. And it helped. Their population consumed less saturated fat and fatty dairy products. I don't know where they are today. And I've asked many people. So if you know more on this story, let me know. I'm at info@realmeals.org, and I'm waiting. I'm waiting to find out what the story really is. We were talking about a children's book. And it's important for children to have storybooks like Happy Animals, Friends, not food. And there's a lot of information about children today, and some of it isn't as heartwarming or positive. There's an editorial in The Lancet, for example, and they're talking about, let me pull it up. It's called... The nice thing about The Lancet is you can register and download their articles for free. There's a lot of reading up there. Protecting children's rights, why governments must be bold to tackle childhood obesity. Now, this is from the UK, and they're talking about problems with children in the UK and how the government needs to make some significant changes. And they highlighted key parts of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child that are relevant to childhood obesity. Now, this is a UN convention that started about 8 years ago. And they highlighted a few articles. Article 3, best interest of the child. The best interest of the child should be the primary consideration in all decisions and actions concerning children when governments are faced with conflicting priorities or lobby groups. Children must be given priority. I would love to see something like that become law. Article 17, access to information from the media. Every child has the right to reliable information from a variety of sources, especially when this has the potential to impact on their social well-being and physical and mental health, and governments should encourage the media to provide information that is socially beneficial. Governments must help protect children from the materials that could harm them. Beautiful, right? Only it's just not happening. Article 24, health and health services. Every child has the right to the best possible standard of health. Governments must ensure good quality health care, clean water, nutritious food, a clean environment, and education on health and well-being so that children can stay healthy. Richer countries should help poorer countries achieve this. I'm letting that sink in, are you? Richer countries should help poorer countries achieve this. Article 27. Adequate standard of living. Every child has the right to a standard of living that is good enough to meet their physical and social needs and support their development. Governments must help families who cannot afford to provide this. And Article 31, leisure, play, and culture. Every child has the right to relax, play, and take part in a wide range of cultural and artistic activities. Change starts when people get together and articulate what's necessary. And the UN Convention on the Rights of Children has done that. And now we need to act and we need to listen. I was reading today in the New York Times stories about children here in New York City. And it's just mind-blowing how over 100,000 children are either homeless or they live in a situation, a very crowded environment with their siblings, their parents. Maybe they're boarding with another family. They have very little room and space. They're not eating well because they don't have access to healthy food. They can't afford it. And this happens here in the United States. So, if you have the chance at your Thanksgiving table, for example, when you're giving thanks, I hope you'll be thinking about those who are not as fortunate. Give thanks for what you have. And there are many ways to help. There are many organizations online that you can help that feed the hungry. There are the soup kitchens. What are you doing? I'd like to know. You could email me at info@realmeals.org. I'm thinking about some of the things that I want to do. I haven't made up my mind yet. But Thanksgiving, I mean, every day should be Thanksgiving, right? Every day we should be grateful for what we have. It's easy to think about what we don't have. And for some reason, it's hard to think about what we do have. But let me tell you something, that when you think about all the good that's in your life and not what you don't have or the things that are going wrong, if you don't focus on those things and you think about the good, life feels so much better. Now, we talked about sanctuaries in the book that they wrote, Leora and Glenn, Happy Animals. The animals are at a sanctuary. There are lots of sanctuaries in the country, and they have wonderful Thanksgiving events. Most of them don't take place on Thanksgiving, and a lot of them have already happened already. But you might think about looking up some of those, like the Woodstock Animal Sanctuary has a wonderful Thanksgiving event, Catskill Animal Sanctuary. Those are the ones I'm familiar with. And then there are some great restaurants in the area that will have vegan Thanksgiving at their restaurant. For example, I am very grateful because this year I am finally going to attend Thanksgiving at Candle 79 in Manhattan. Candle 79 is a wonderful restaurant. The owners, Bart Potenza and Joy Pearson, are wonderful people. And the sad news is Candle 79 is closing at the end of the year. Why? Because the landlord is going to be knocking down all the structures in the corner where that building is on 79th and Lexington to build a luxury condominium. I'm not grateful for that, that's for sure. But I am grateful for all the years we got to experience the love and deliciousness at Candle 79. So if you're in the New York metro area between now and the end of the year, I hope you will treat yourself to an experience at Candle 79 before they're gone. Yep, before they're gone. Some other crazy things. We just have like a few minutes left, but that company, Nestle, is really a no-no. So not only do they try and get the water rights all over the country so that they can bottle water and sell it to you, and they've done that, for example, 2 years ago in Michigan, they fought and won to be able to pump even more water than they were pumping out of Michigan. And this is when Michigan has, you know, this horrific problem with Flint, for example, and the nightmare that's going on with the water there. And now they're vying for water down in Florida. But I brought them up because there's a wonderful little small company, the Herbivorous Butcher. And I've had the brother and sister team on this show. They make plant meats. And they applied for a trademark on their name. And they didn't get it. And then Nestle applied for it and got it. So now the Herbivorous Butcher is suing Nestle. And this is amazing because this is like David and Goliath. And I wish them I wish them well. I remember one of my favorite restaurants in Santa Cruz, actually in Aptos, California, back in, I think, the 70s, they called themselves McDharma's. And McDonald's forced this tiny little restaurant to take the Mick off. And they've been Dharma's ever since. So good luck to the herbivorous butcher. Am I saying that right? Herbivorous, herbivorous. You say, I say. Anyway, the last thing, well, one of the last things I wanted to talk about is, you know how I'm always making recipes, and I'm always making recipes for food that I want to be delicious and nutritious. We post these restaurants at responsibilityandliving.com. You're always welcome to go there. Well, I've also been playing with recipes for personal care items, and I just made a new hand cream that I'm so excited about. I really like the do-it-yourself thing because there are so many ingredients, even in the kind of products you buy in the natural food store. There can be ingredients that you really don't need in your products. I like products to put on my skin that I can eat, pretty simply. And I've made this wonderful new hand cream with shea butter, cocoa butter, and coconut oil. And what I love about it is you mix it up, you warm it up so it all melts together, then you let it cool, and then you whip it with a beater, an electric beater, and it looks great. It looks like you want to eat it. It looks like frosting. It's so good, and we're really enjoying using it. So at some point soon, I'll post that recipe at responsibilityandliving.com, and maybe you'll get a chance to try it. I hope you do, because that's what it's all about. Sharing, giving, serving. And I think I'll end it there. So thanks for joining me today. We listened to Leora Raphael and Glenn Sachs talk about their book, Happy Animals, Friends Not Food. I hope you pick up a copy for your favorite 2 to 7-year-old. And have a really wonderful, delicious week.